today's episode of the Axon Creative Podcast is brought to you by Hover. Hover knows you're going to do something that will make a difference. Grab your domain name at hover.com/accidentalcreative for a 10% discount on all new purchases. Make a name for yourself with Hover. This episode is also sponsored by Patreon. Start creating on your own terms. Earn a steady, reliable income and the freedom to make what you love. Sign up today at patreon.com. That's patreon.com. Hey everyone, welcome to the Accidental Creative Podcast. My name is Todd Henry. I'm your host. I am also the author of the new book, The Motivation Code, available now wherever books are sold. Discover the hidden forces that drive your best work. Learn more at toddhenry.com/mcode. That's toddhenry.com/mcode. So often I am asked, and yes, I am often asked, what is the one thing that distinguishes people who produce brilliant bodies of work over time, who seem to manage to create something that resonates deeply? What's the difference between those people and people who burn out, people who fizzle out, people who never really accomplish what it is they set out to accomplish creatively? And the answer, frankly, is that those who produce bodies of work that they can be proud of are those who consistently produce every single day. They produce something every single day. They recognize that steady progress is the most important factor in long-term accomplishment. Well, on today's show, we have someone who is no stranger to the Axon Creative Podcast audience. His name is Seth Godin. He has been modeling this behavior for many, many years. He's the author of a number of best-selling books, and his new book is called The Practice, and it's about how to bring creative engagement every single day. I can't wait to dive into the conversation with him. Here's Seth Godin. Well, it is a great joy to have back on the show today, Seth Godin. Seth is the author of, I mean, frankly, I think probably most of my favorite books. It's probably fair to say that. He has a new book. It's called The Practice. It is outstanding, as you would expect. Seth Godin, welcome back to the Accidental Creative Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. And I owe you a debt, but I probably should have called the book The Unaccidental Creative, but that doesn't have the same ring to it.
Not quite, no.
It's always good to talk to a fellow trailblazer and ruckus maker.
I appreciate that. And the irony is, I think that we were writing about the same thing. I was doing it ironically, which I've discovered is not a good way to title a book. It's not good to title a book ironically sometimes. But
well, calling a book All Marketers Are Liars makes me the worst offender. So it's okay.
Well, this new book is just phenomenal. It is. I breezed through it. I couldn't put it down. And in many ways, I feel like this topic has been the through line of much of your work for the past several years, and you finally have kind of pulled all of it together into a book, put it in one place. I think maybe a great place to start is, you know, could we just talk about the title, The Practice? What is The Practice as you describe it?
The Practice insulates us from all of the speed bumps that we hit because we grasp for outcome. Mm. The practice is the better version of ourselves in the sense that we can always rely on the practice. The practice means we show up, we chop the wood, we carry the water, we do this work for the people we seek to serve, whether or not it worked yesterday, whether or not we're in the mood, whether or not the muse has visited us, we do this work because it turns out that that's what makes us feel in flow. That's what makes us inspired. We don't write because we're inspired. We're inspired because we write.
Well, you frame this up in terms of outcome-based thinking versus practice-based thinking. And you give the example, I thought it was a phenomenal example of juggling. You talked about how you try to teach people juggling, and people think juggling is about catching, but juggling is not about catching. Juggling is about throwing, which is a process thing, not an outcome thing, right? But this process versus practice, or outcome versus practice thinking, it's so easy for us to get fixated on outcomes. How do we shift our mindset to thinking about practice versus outcome? Because it's so ingrained in us.
You bet it is. And if you've ever seen a juggling show, you notice that they caught everything. You don't notice that they were good at throwing. If you were ever good in third grade at anything, you paid attention to the fact that you didn't get in trouble, that you didn't fail a test, that you fit into the system, that the system needs us to fit in to maintain the status quo, and the system keeps track of outcomes because that's so much easier than keeping track of process and the practice. And so the system brainwashes us to not trusting ourselves. And the original title for the book was Trust Yourself, because what the system has said to us is, do not trust yourself, trust the outcomes, and the system will tell you if you are doing a good job. And that is the best way to keep someone from being creative.
I hear you, and I agree with you. I think you know we're on the same page about this. And I think this, what you're describing, is a really difficult thing to embrace, because I think I'm sort of putting myself in the mind of somebody who's asking the question, well, but I have to make a living, and my living is largely mm-hmm. based upon how good the work I put into the world is. And if my work is not up to par, then I'm not going to be able to do all these things like support myself, keep a roof over my head, yep. all of those things. And I think those thoughts become, you know, we obsessively focus on those thoughts. You know, is there a way that we can short circuit that? I mean, what can we do to help ourselves be more process focused versus outcome focused?
Well, first we should talk about the words, and then we should talk about the stakes. The words good enough, under par, meeting spec, these words are challenging, because, you know, the difference between a great pop song in 1969 and a not great pop song have nothing to do with whether it sold a lot of copies. That had to do with luck and structure. It had to do with personal taste. And we can look back or look forward at things that people create and say, well, that's good because it was a hit. But those aren't related. We can say it's good and it was a hit, but they're not one causing the other. But leaving that part aside completely, what I'm talking about when we're talking about the stakes is this: you are not entitled to make a living doing this work. Mm-hmm. And it would be foolish to quit your job and believe that simply because you were putting effort into the process, you will make a living doing this work. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, let's take 2 hours of Netflix time and 2 hours of Facebook time every day and put them instead into doing work you could be proud of by committing to a practice of putting ideas into the world that you're not sure are any good until you put them into the world, and then improving them with no expectation of recompense or payment. Do that, do that, do that. And it is possible. In fact, it is more likely than any other method that if you do that, you will end up getting paid for it. But you're not doing it to get paid for it. You're doing it because you can make a contribution.
So many great artists that I know, and I'm sure that you know as well. I mean, all of them were making things well before they got paid for making things. They were making them because they loved to make them. And most of them were working jobs that they didn't necessarily care about, but those jobs fueled their ability to spend their time making art, you know, versus the other way around, which is, I think, what most people want. But I think there's this misnomer, and you talk about this topic of passion in the book, and the way that we sometimes misunderstand passion in our culture. Could you elaborate on that a bit? Because I see this as well, and it concerns me, because I think it really affects our ability to engage in the work in a meaningful way.
Yeah. So a lot of people say, I wish I had a job I could be passionate about. These are people who, if someone from 1840 had the job they have now, that person would think they had died and become the king of France, right? That it's all relative. That you work indoors in an air-conditioned space where you have time to listen to podcasts, there's free coffee, and people treat you with respect and dignity, but you're not passionate about the work because it doesn't exactly match that perfect thing you're imagining. And a lot of talk on the internet is all about, if you can find your passion, then you're work becomes beautiful and magic. And I think the opposite is a much more productive path, which is, why not choose to be passionate about the work you do? Because that is completely up to you. You do not need the world to realign in any way. And so, I don't know about you, but I have met passionate frontline workers at the Avis rent-a-car counter. And I have met passionate librarians. And I have met passionate keyboard players. But I've also met people who are keyboard players in a wedding band getting paid, who are just grousing about the fact that they're not in a jazz band. And I have met keyboardists in a jazz band who are getting paid, who are grousing about the fact that they're not a headliner, and on and on and on. We can pick, choose, decide to be passionate about the opportunity that we have. And if you really and truly cannot find one person who does what you do for a living who is passionate about it, then I think you need to find something else to do for a living. Mm. But those are the only people who need to quit their job.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that example of the keyboard player. When I was in my, my early 20s, I now call them my misguided early 20s, but they really weren't. It's kind of a joke. I say that to my kids. I was a full-time musician and I traveled and we got to open for all of these, big acts and play in front of all these people. And it was really interesting to me because from night to night, depending on who we happened to be sharing the stage with that night, some people were just the most lovely, welcoming, enjoyable people to be around, these big acts. And some of them were just the most bitter, angry, frustrated, closed off people. I mean, they would literally close themselves in their dressing room until 5 minutes before showtime, go do their show. Then they were on the bus and they were out of there. Didn't want to interact with anyone. And over time, I started to see a pattern within these acts. And what I realized, Seth, was that the people who were enjoyable were the people who loved making music. They would be making music in a tiny little pizza joint in, rural Alabama if they had to. They would totally be doing that and working a job to support that. They're just thrilled they get to be on stage. And some of these people were some of the biggest stars in the industry. They were huge names, but they loved being on a bus, riding in a metal tube down the road with a bunch of sweaty guys going to the next venue, and setting up and playing again. They didn't care where they were doing it. And it was interesting because way back then, I think I realized that you could be doing the exact same thing and doing what you always thought you wanted to do and be completely miserable doing it if the act of doing that thing isn't what brings you joy. If that's not what you're trying to do, then even getting this thing you always thought you wanted can make you miserable. And I saw that play out in real time when I was on stage with these people.
That's a great story. I have a story that's not in the book that I'll tell you. So I have no idea if I will ever be back on stage again. But back in the day, I gave 1,000 speeches. Here are some of the rules if you're going to be a keynote speaker and you get choices. Don't speak at a convention center because the acoustics are horrible. Mm-hmm. Don't speak in a place where they don't speak the same language that you speak because simultaneous translation is a miracle, but it's also extremely distracting because you're hearing all the leakage and there's a delay. So if you try to say anything that's funny, it's weird because some people laugh right away and some people laugh like 8 seconds later and it's a mess. and then the third rule is don't speak at a gig where you're one of a bunch of speakers, some of whom are more appealing to the audience than you are because they're not there for you. So I did a gig in Mexico in a convention center with a whole bunch of other speakers. So I'm up there, and in the fourth row, there's a woman who's on her cell phone while I'm talking. But she's not on her cell phone listening to a conversation. She's on her cell phone having a conversation, talking as loud as I'm talking to you right now, while I am giving my talk.
Wow.
In Spanish. I'm not in Spanish. She's in Spanish. And I decide that I'm going to give my talk to her, that I'm going to, my talks are always different, but often the slides are consistent. So I'm using the slides to tell a different talk about how cell phones and social media and interruption and all this stuff. And I'm not landing one glove on this person, not one. And I realize I have made a huge mistake because I've stolen from the 2,000 people in the room who are there for me. I've stolen from them because this woman isn't there for me. And so I stopped instantly after like 4 minutes of this and realized what you focus on changes your posture. And I decided it's going to be a long time before I'm back in this convention center giving a simultaneously translated speech to these 2,000 people. But right now I am here. And right now I have a chance to make a difference for them. And I got to tell you, the rest of the day went way better because I had given up control of the outcome to someone who didn't want me to dance with them. And instead, I was working with people who were there for me.
And that change in mindset makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the discard pile and the importance of the discard pile?
Yeah. So this cartoonist for the New Yorker named Drew, he's like one of the top 10 cartoonists there. If you're a panel cartoonist who does New Yorker style cartoons, they're called New Yorker style cartoons for a reason, because you want them to be in the New Yorker. And every week, hundreds of people try to get in the New Yorker and almost no one does. And Drew posted a picture of his desk. And I, with his permission, included the picture in the book. There are two stacks. One stack is 400 pages of paper. And you can see on top is a cartoon that's hard to make out. And it says, there's a post-it on it that says, no. And then there's another stack of 5 pieces of paper, maybe 10, with a post-it on top that says, yes. And the punchline is simple, which is that for every cartoon that Drew sells to the New Yorker, he draws and completes 50 or 100. And so it's easy to say, well, he's so talented. No, he just has more no's in his no pile than you do. That's it. He has more no's than you do. And if we can embrace this practice of generosity, of giving up control over the outcome, and eagerly adding to the no pile as we get better at our craft, those three steps enable us to find our voice.
Hey, everyone, just want to take a quick minute to let you know this podcast is sponsored by Patreon. So as a creator, it can feel like you're making stuff for practically everyone but yourself. Patreon is a creator-founded membership platform where you can build a reliable income stream to fuel your creative independence. No advertisers, no algorithms, no mainstream gatekeepers holding your paycheck or telling you what to do. On Patreon, the people who love what you make can directly support it with paid subscriptions. In return, they'll get access to exclusive content and custom rewards. Find the creative freedom to do your best work and the financial stability to make it possible. If you're an illustrator, video creator, podcaster, artist, or creative person of any kind, sign up today on patreon.com. That's patreon.com and start creating on your own terms. This episode is also sponsored by Hover. Listen, Hover knows that whatever you do, whatever kind of art you make, whatever kind of work you do, you want to do something great. Well, Hover wants you to start that something great with them. With Hover, you can register a domain name for your design portfolio, for example. Hover has over 400 domain name extensions to choose from when building your brand online. No matter what area of the creative space you are in, there's a domain name waiting for it, from .design to .art to .ink to .photo and so much more. You're going to find excellent technical support available to answer any questions you may have. They have best-in-class customer and technical support. And listen, if you've experienced accidentalcreative.com or toddhenry.com, you've experienced Hover, because we have all of our domain names registered with Hover. As a matter of fact, we have dozens and we absolutely love them. Listen, Hover knows you will do something that will make a difference. So grab your domain name at hover.com/accidentalcreative for a 10% discount on all new purchases. Make a name for yourself with Hover. And now back to Seth Godin. I think this is so deeply connected to the first thing that we were talking about, this idea that, you know, we're so focused on outcome. And I think there's a misunderstanding among a lot of people that work just comes out in perfect form. I'm sure, Seth, when you write books, you just type it beginning to end in exact form. You know, I'm sure that you do. I know that I certainly don't. We have shared an editor, Nikki Papadopoulos, who is phenomenal at portfolio. And, you know, people will often say to me, how long are your books? And I'll say, well, they're about 60 to 70,000 words. And they would say, well, there's no way I could type 60 or 70,000 words. There's no way. And I would say, oh, no, I actually type about 120,000 words to get to those 60,000. Like, Nikki actually came to me during the edit of my last book and said, hey, this chapter, it's not working. Like, we're going to get rid of this chapter. It was about 7,000 words that she just like, in one fell swoop, just dropped right from the book. But the reality is, to your point about the discard pile, you have to be willing. You can't hold things too precious, right? You have to be willing to just push through, to write, to create, and recognize some of this is going to land on the discard pile. And some of it, if I write enough of it, is going to be good enough to put out into the world.
Yeah. So we have similar stories about this. I believe you can type a book in 3 days. Mm. So therefore, everything that takes longer than 3 days is not typing, it's writing, it's rewriting, it's thinking, it's editing. That's the hard part of writing a book. Yeah. And the book I worked the longest on was the book that sold the fewest copies, Survival Is Not Enough. And I wrote more than 200,000 words for it. And the thing, I worked on it 8 hours a day, every day for a year. The thing about it that worked for me is I created a new Word file called For Later. And when I took a chapter out, I didn't delete it. I just copied it. I cut it and pasted it into the other file. Mm. So I have a file with 120,000 words in it from 20 years ago because I couldn't bear to delete them.
Yeah.
But putting them into something called For Later made me feel better.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think anybody who is engaged in the practice, I mean, they're going to, that's actually a really great tip. You know, I mean, just because it's not for now doesn't mean it's for never. And, you know, that discard pile might just be a matter of timing. It might be that for some reason, something's not quite right. It needs to be further refined. It doesn't mean that it's forever irrelevant and should never see, you know, see the public in any capacity.
Right. And so now we get to this idea of extremes. You mentioned work being perfect. There's some albums that people can listen to. I think they might even be streaming now. Billy Joel's demos, Crosby, Stills, and Nash's demos, and all of the outtakes from Bob Dylan. And when you listen to these recordings, what you realize is they're terrible. They're mm-hmm. terrible. And part of it is they don't sound like we think they should sound because they're not hits. Mm-hmm. And part of it is they're just terrible. They're out of tune. The sentences don't work yet, because they've evolved over time. And then you can consider the story of Leonard Cohen's song, Hallelujah, which everyone has heard, which took 8 years, versus a song like Tangled Up in Blue, which took 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And they're extremes, right? So both songs end up being part of the canon. Everyone knows something about both songs, but there's no evidence that Leonard Cohen's last 3 years of work on the song mattered, nor is there evidence that if Bob Dylan had spent another week on the song, it would have been better. So what we learn is there is a practice, but if it doesn't ship, it doesn't count. And shipping the work has to be part of the practice, which is we say, I'm going to show up here to do this generous work, and then I'm going to ship it, and I'm going to put it in front of the right people. And whatever they say is whatever they say. And then I'm going to go back to work.
Mm. Yeah. So I want to ask about that because I think that's the hard part for a lot of people. Like people maybe are listening and saying, okay, yeah, I can embrace the idea of making things, but shipping things feels different to me. That feels a bit dangerous to me. What would be your words of encouragement to those people?
Well, of course it's dangerous. And you should not ship things that are hurtful. You should not ship things that you're not proud of. But there's a lot to be said for the fact that you can ship things without your name on them. And that's a fine place to start if you want to be able to show up with a blog without your name on it, to be able to show up and put your songs on iTunes under somebody else's group name, to just put the work in the world without you feeling like you are being judged. And, you know, the same thing is true for consulting. The same thing is true for selling. If you want to get good at selling, I don't think you should go get a fancy job as a salesperson. I think you should find a charity you believe in and go raise money for them. You don't need the charity's permission. Just send the money in once you raise it. Yeah. And if you fail, you failed. But no one knows you failed because you didn't raise any money. And if you succeed, the practice has taught you something about how to make a sale.
You know, I wonder if maybe some of these ideas, some of these concerns are shifting among younger generations, this idea of being afraid to ship. During all of the coronavirus stuff, our family suddenly found ourselves with a lot of time on our hands, our kids did for sure. And, my oldest son, who's a musician, just came downstairs and we were talking about something. He's like, yeah, I've released two albums during this time. He had recorded on a MacBook Air in his bedroom, recorded and released two albums. They were on Spotify, Apple Music, everything. Like he had done the whole thing, figured it out. And I had no idea this was even going on, right? But just, I feel like maybe this idea of I make things and I put them into the world, maybe it's because there's so much out there now. Like they don't feel like I know growing up, I didn't know anybody who had recorded and released music, you know, but like he has friends who have done these things. So maybe just the attitude is shifting a bit among this younger generation.
Well, it's interesting because what we've done in certain fields is demystified them by creating a surplus of choice. Mm. But if you say to him or to anybody, what about organizing a course online about how to play the bass? Or what about editing this Wikipedia article instead of complaining about it? Sooner or later, you will find a thing where people go, oh, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
Because it's something that brings with it the drama that undermines the practice. Mm. And so that's why, I mean, I worked very hard to make the book timeless in that respect, which is if there's no drama, then there's no art. There might be creativity, there might be generosity, but the drama of the resistance only shows up when we feel like there's something at stake. Yeah. And it's when there's something at stake that I'm much more comfortable calling it art.
Yeah. Well, Seth, I always enjoy talking with you and I love reading your words. I'm so grateful that you have another book out. You have been very generous with people. I think a lot of people aren't aware. They're aware of your generosity with your work and your books, but they're not aware of how generous you are with your time and your advice to other people who just seek your advice. And you've been a tremendous mentor from afar and behind the scenes to me. And I'm just so grateful that you took the time to be with us today. If people want to come find you and learn more about Seth Godin, where can they go?
So Seth's.blog is 7,500 blog posts for free. And if you go to Seth's.blog/the practice, there's the book. And the workshops we run are at akimbo.com. That's akimbo.com. And you can find more than you need to know just by visiting there.
And the book is called The Practice, and it is available now. Seth Godin, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, you're so kind. Thank you for making this ruckus. It really matters to a lot of people. Thanks.
And as always, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts or at accidentalcreative.com. Remember, friends, cover bands don't change the world. Don't be a cover band. You need to find your unique voice if you want to thrive. We'll see you next time.